U.S. versus Strand. Mr. Stenger?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Steve Stenger, and I was appointed through the Criminal Justice Act to represent Jerry Strahan in the district court proceedings below, which ultimately resulted in the conviction of Mr. Strahan to two counts of an indictment. Count one was for conspiracy to distribute heroin and cocaine base, and count eight, he was also found guilty of distribution of cocaine base. As a result of an 851 enhancement that was filed by the government in the case for two priors that Mr. Strahan allegedly had, he received a life sentence in this case, in this matter.
Was there any question that he had two priors, was there?
Your Honor, he did not, we did not object to the priors themselves, and that he actually did have those priors. That is true.
So the life sentence was the mandatory minimum in this case.
I do raise that in some of the, I do have several issues that address the constitutional concerns with all this, and I have been sitting here and listening to several other cases that have dealt with those issues. And that is true, Your Honor. What is particularly upsetting in this case for the defendant and for me as well as his representative was that with respect to at least count eight, we're dealing with a very, I would say, a relatively small amount of cocaine base. And for the conspiracy itself, I don't believe that there was ever an actual quantity that was placed on it. But because of this case, this man did receive a life sentence. I was hoping to focus on the fifth issue in my brief, which dealt with the sufficiency of the evidence in the case.
Before you get to that,
yes, Your Honor.
What was driving that mandatory minimum life sentence was his priors?
That is correct, Your Honor, yes.
Right. And how many were there?
With respect to priors that were pled in the 851 enhancement, there were two.
Okay.
And with respect to
This is in the nature of a three strikes and you're out kind of a statutory scheme.
It was that sort of a situation. It's a little different than a three strikes and you're out, I suppose, because they're very particularized crimes that we're talking about, those being felony drug offenses. Yes.
Okay.
With respect to the issue first that I wanted to focus on, it deals with the sufficiency of the evidence, and I am aware of the very high burden that exists with regard to this issue, but nevertheless, I do believe that it's worth addressing to the court. My argument is follows. There was insufficient evidence to support a conviction because no reasonable trier of fact could have found the essential elements necessary for a conviction under violation of Title 21 USC, the applicable sections of 841 and 846. In this case, we are dealing with a life sentence, and with respect to the evidence that was adduced by the government at trial, what we were basically looking at and what was basically brought forth by the government at trial were the defendants' co-defendants. There were some things that they all had in common with respect to their testimony, and there were some things that were somewhat different. And before I go into that, I'd like to also mention that with respect to the defendant, there was no physical evidence that was seized from the defendant at any time in the case that would indicate that he was taking part in the activity alleged in the indictment. There was a seizure of the alleged drug house, which was known as 1208 College. There was a search and seizure of that residence, and it revealed no property of the defendants whatsoever. With respect, as I've stated, there was no physical evidence to support the convictions. Particularly, there were no items of contraband that were found belonging anywhere to the defendant. The officers in question who did conduct surveillance in this case did observe no hand-to-hand drug transactions involving the defendant. So basically, what we were left with was the testimony of four of his co-defendants. They all, of course, underwent direct and cross-examination. One of the individuals that testified was Johnny McCray, Sr. With respect to Mr. McCray, he was asked on direct and he was asked on cross essentially for particular instances of where the defendant, essentially where, when, how, all the particulars that you could ask for as to the drug transactions in question that Mr. Strahan, the defendant, took part in. At all times in his testimony, he was unable to provide any particulars whatsoever with regard to where, of course, in general, where the drug transactions took place was allegedly at the house on College. But particularly where in the house, where on the property, when on the property. It sounded a lot like they had read the period of the indictment, which was a relatively broad-ranging period, ranging from November of 2003 to December of 2004. They all basically just made a blanket statement that it was in the period that was covered by the indictment. No particulars about any particular drug transactions in question, and they were cross-examined with regard to that, and particularly with respect to Mr. McRae, and I would say this goes across the board to all of the defendants. They could provide no particulars about what Mr. Strahan was doing, other than that he dealt drugs with them, that he lived in the house with them at times, and that he lived in another house, which was on 23rd Street in East St. Louis as well, that he lived there and that he dealt drugs with them as well. There was also another item of evidence in the case that was a tape. It was a tape that was reduced to a CD recording, and a confidential informant by the name of Joseph Mitchell actually gave his testimony to in some way interpret what was going on in this tape. And the court should know that it was a tape of very poor quality. And even after being prepped by the government, he was, of course, asked about that. After being prepped by the government, he still, while he sat on the stand, had difficulty listening to the tape. There was also an issue that occurred in the case where an FBI 302 report did not match this particular transaction that we're talking about, and this was the September 29th, 2003 transaction that allegedly involved my client, which makes up what is essentially count 8 of the indictment. Mr. Mitchell was essentially unable to describe what was going on in the tape because, once again, it was an audio tape. It was not a videotape. There were some numbers that were mentioned. It sounded like perhaps someone was calling for change, someone was calling for drugs. It was very, very, very difficult to discriminate who was saying what. But out of this mess, he somehow was able to state that my client was providing drugs to him in some fashion. There was an FBI 302 that completely contradicted what his version of the events were. The FBI, or the task force agent, Officer Gimple, who testified to this matter, admitted that the versions of the stories did not match. Therefore, with all that I've stated, I believe that there's insufficient evidence in the case and that that Mr. Strahan should receive the relief that we prayed for in the brief. The next issue that I'd like to discuss and that I would like to address is my issue number 3, which is that the trial court erred when it did not give a public authority instruction when it was presented.
Well, he denied, though, that he'd done any of this, didn't he?
Your Honor, he did deny that on the stand, that he had taken part in particular transactions that the government had asked him about. Nevertheless, at the point that we gave this instruction, of course, we didn't have the jury's finding as to what the jury and the essentially the way the jury was going to go on it. However, what we did have is there was underlying evidence to support the instruction, particularly evidence as it related to a particular United States Marshal who had essentially during the period of the indictment began having dealings with Mr. Strahan. Mr. Strahan produced numerous items of evidence that showed that this U.S. Marshal had paid Mr. Strahan for information, and the information was about the individuals that were also indicted in this conspiracy, several of his co-defendants and some of their associates as well. The United States Marshal in question knew at all times that he was going into this group, that he was residing with this group, that he was associating himself with this group. The United States Marshal also knew that this was a group that was certainly involved in the drug trade, that they were purchasing heroin, selling heroin, and that they were also doing the same with crack. So this United States Marshal was paying Mr. Strahan to do these things and essentially pushing him into this environment. And it should also be noted that some of the other things that this United States Marshal was doing, he was actually, when Mr. Strahan would violate his parole, or if he would violate his parole or the probation that he may have been on, he was actually getting him placed back on that parole and back on that probation and actually getting his violations removed. So he was very much an active participant, essentially placing Mr. Strahan as much as the United States Marshal could back into this environment and giving Jerry Strahan, I believe, the reasonable inference that he could be there, that he could associate with these individuals.
But isn't that theory of defense inconsistent with and incompatible with the denial? To get back to Judge Keeney's question?
And, Your Honor, perhaps it is, for sake of argument, perhaps it is, but because it's an inconsistent theory of defense, does it necessarily mean that he cannot try to employ that if it would work in the if we
oh,
have
sure
the underlying evidence?
Sure it does. When you're at trial, you got to pick. If you, for example, a self-defense defense, you can't deny that you did the act and then assert a self-defense defense. Those are two fundamentally inconsistent theories of defense, and it seems to me a denial that he participated in any of this conduct and then a request that the jury be instructed on public authority that there was a law enforcement officer who lured him into participating into the offense or lulled him into thinking that his participation was legal or would be forgiven because he was working with the law enforcement officer. Those are two inconsistent things. Can't have it both ways.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that if we review even the portions of Mr. Strahan's testimony that the government cites, there certainly were in his testimony very much allusions that he was dealing with these individuals on a very regular basis. And the government cites this in their brief testimony that he took in drugs for fixing vehicles and whatnot. So it's not as if he was completely denying anything and everything that had to do with drugs per se.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel? Stanger? Sit at the counsel table.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. James Crow on behalf of the United States. I'll take the issues in reverse order, starting with the public authority instruction that the Counsel for Defense has just discussed with the Court. And I think the Court has correctly noted that the defendant here was essentially asking the district court to allow him to have his cake and eat it, too. That is to say, my testimony was, and it was exactly on my cross-examination question, you said you believe that you had authority to do what is alleged against you in this case because Deputy United States Marshal Tom Woods told you so. Is that correct? Answer, no, that's not correct. I wasn't doing what was alleged in this case. So as the court has correctly pointed out, he was trying to have the court issue essentially a completely separate instruction that would find or require the jury to find, well, he said he wasn't doing it, but he's asking us to find potentially that if we're going to convict him, step back and consider for a moment whether or not he labored under the misapprehension, even for a moment, that he had the public authority of the United States Marshal Service to engage in this illegal conduct. And I think the district court's decision and election within its discretion not to issue that instruction was amply supported on several bases, not the least of which was the fact that the defendant adduced no evidence that, in fact, he relied on this public authority. Moreover, on a further legal basis, the United States adduced evidence through both Deputy U.S. Marshal Tom Woods and, in rebuttal, Deputy U.S. Marshal Sean Newland, that established that the Marshal Service is not possessed of Title 21 investigative authority. And in fact, they were not possessed of the requisite authority to confer that authority to engage in illegal narcotics trafficking to Defendant Strahan.
Involved in a joint task force.
Correct. That was Deputy Newland, Your Honor. And Deputy Newland was the only individual who had been deputized by the FBI. However, his testimony was on rebuttal that he did not participate in this investigation, had never had any contact with Mr. Strahan, and most certainly did not grant him a conferral of public authority to engage in the charged conduct in counts 1 and 8. And that was the purpose for calling him on rebuttal, was to dispel any remnant possibility that that could have been a misunderstanding between the Marshal Service and Defendant Strahan. I'd note, too, here that in terms of the abuse of discretion standard, the district court held the jury instruction conference on a Thursday evening and refused the public authority instruction at that time. We had a holiday on Friday and came back in on Monday morning having reviewed additional case law on the public authority issue and went on to again ask defense counsel if there was anything further that they had to add, because in light of the court's further review of case law that the defendant had not adduced evidence and was not entitled to the instruction as a matter of law. So under the abuse of discretion standard, certainly, Your Honors, this was a well-contemplated and legally founded decision by the district court. Turning in reverse turn to then to the issue of sufficiency of the evidence, I take great exception to counsel's representation that there was no physical evidence in this case. In fact, for each of the enumerated counts of the indictment that charged substantive controlled purchases of narcotics made by confidential informants working for the FBI from various members of this conspiracy, there were both body recordings, audio recordings of the buy, as well as the physical drug evidence introduced at trial as the evidence of the conspiracy and its trafficking of in excess of 50 grams of crack cocaine. This defendant's participation in the September 29, 2004 sale of crack and heroin that is the subject of count 8, and it was charged simply as a distribution of crack cocaine in excess of 5 grams, was constituted of 12.3 grams of crack, so well nigh over one-fifth of the statutory threshold for the sentence that he ultimately faced. That's Exhibit 7. Exhibit 8 was the 0.5 grams of heroin. And then there was, of course, the body recording made by Joe Mitchell, the confidential informant. I'd note at this juncture that defense counsel seems to be making an attempt to attack the credibility of Joe Mitchell at this juncture. That's not raised in the brief. The FBI 302 issue that he raised was resolved at trial, evidently to the satisfaction of the jury, and any challenge to the credibility of the witness should not be considered in the sufficiency context at this juncture. We also had the testimony of all four of the other co-conspirators who testified live for the jury. Both confidential informants authenticated the recordings that were made, and we also had the testimony of Special Federal Officer Brian Gimple, who was on the FBI task force and worked with these CIs. He went to the he testified to the issue of the security of these recordings and the practices followed with these CIs and their reliability in other instances. As it relates to the sufficiency on count 8, Your Honor, the Joe Mitchell, the second confidential informant, shows up on any given day at 1208 College and is able to buy crack cocaine and heroin. On September 29th of 2004, his testimony was he showed up without direction as to who to buy from in particular, but that he was able to buy on that day from John McRae Jr., acting together with Mitchell Brown and Jerry Strahan, who ultimately delivered the physical custody of the drugs to the confidential informant, received $500 and changed him $20, which represented the agreed-upon price between the confidential informant and John McRae Jr., which was $480. As to the conspiracy writ large, this conspiracy spanned a full year from November of 2003 into December of 2004, and the defendant's conduct was consistent throughout, as represented by the fact that he was still in it some 3 months before the conclusion of the conspiracy. Moreover, there was testimony by Special Federal Officer Gimple that in surveillance that was undertaken after the search warrant that was executed at 1208 College in December of 2004, that Strahan was found circulating still with the McRae's and other co-conspirators at their new distribution location on 23rd Street in East St. Louis. So there's no evidence that he withdrew at any point during the conspiracy. And in fact, Strahan's testimony was that he was dealing with these people on a regular basis, so much so that he was able to provide information to the Marshal Service about their whereabouts at different points in time. And Woods' testimony on that point was that he was paid for that information and nothing more. So the defendant's assertion that there were no particulars is belied by the fact that there was ample evidence adduced in the court, the district court, regarding the body wires and the physical drug evidence. In terms of what was seized in the search warrant, I do take limited exception to counsel's representation that nothing relating to Jerry Strahan was seized there. In fact, Government's Exhibit 10 was a letter from John McRae Sr., who was then incarcerated, to John McRae Jr. at the 1208 College address that mentions none other than defendant Jerry Strahan, asking if he and Black, which was the evidence was the nickname for Mitchell Brown, what they were doing and whether Black and Jerry had been screwing up again, to put it politely, and goes on to say he'd be out real soon from Department of Corrections and just hold things down until then. This evinces John Sr.'s understanding of the ongoing conspiracy, even in his absence, and this letter being found in the very house where this drug trafficking was going on is evidence that relates to Strahan. In terms of the defendant's challenges based on the 851 notice, I submit that at least as to their point one, they conceded that issue and raised it only in the event of a change in the law, and no such change has been forthcoming. If there are no further questions of the court, I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Your Honor.
How much time? 5 minutes. All right. Thank you. Mr. Stenger, you took this case by appointment, or continued appointment, I guess it would be, and you have the thanks of the court for the representation of your client. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.